Chapter 52. Hopeless cripple all his life. Personally, I never went near him. I never saw him again, after the awful evening when I stood by, a watchful but ignored spectator of his scene with Miss Alden. He was in due course discharged from the hospital, and his relative, so I was told, had carried him off somewhere. My information was completed nearly 2 years later. The opportunity, certainly, was not of my seeking. It was quite accidentally that I met a much trusted woman revolutionist at the house of a distinguished Russian gentleman of liberal convictions, who came to live in Geneva for a time. He was a quite different sort of celebrity from Peter Ivanovich, a dark-haired man with kind eyes, high-shouldered, courteous, and with something hushed and circumspect in his manner. He approached me, choosing the moment when there was no one near, followed by a gray-haired, alert lady in a crimson blouse. "Our Sofia Antonovna wishes to be made known to you," he addressed me, in his guarded voice. "And so I leave you two, to have a talk together. I would never have intruded myself upon your notice," the gray-haired lady began at once, "if I had not been charged with a message for you." It was a message of a few friendly words from Natalia Alden. Sofia Antonovna had just returned from a secret excursion into Russia, and had seen Miss Alden. She lived in a town and the center, sharing her compassionate labors between the horrors of overcrowded jails, and the heartrending misery of bereaved homes. She did not spare herself in good service, Sofia Antonovna assured me. "She has a faithful soul, an undaunted spirit and an indefatigable body," the woman revolutionist summed it all up, with a touch of enthusiasm. A conversation thus engaged was not likely to drop from want of interest on my side. We went to sit apart in a corner, where no one interrupted us. In the course of our talk about Miss Alden, Sofia Antonovna remarked suddenly, "I suppose you remember seeing me before? That evening when Natalia came to ask Peter Ivanovich for the address of a certain Razumov, that young man who..." "I remember perfectly," I said. When Sofia Antonovna learned that I had in my possession that young man's journal given me by Miss Alden, she became intensely interested. She did not conceal her curiosity to see the document. I offered to show it to her, and she at once volunteered to call on me next day for that purpose. She turned over the pages greedily for an hour or more, and then handed me the book with a faint sigh. While moving about Russia, she had seen Razumov too. He lived, not in the center, but in the south. She described to me a little two-roomed wooden house, in the suburb of some very small town, hiding within the high plank fence of a yard overgrown with nettles. He was crippled, ill, getting weaker every day, and Tekla the Samaritan tended him unweariedly with the pure joy of unselfish devotion. There was nothing in that task to become disillusioned about. I did not hide from Sofia Antonovna my surprise that she should have visited Mr. Razumov. I did not even understand the motive. But she informed me that she was not the only one. Some of us always go to see him when passing through. He is intelligent. We has ideas. He talks well too. Presently I heard for the first time of Razumov's public confession in Laspara's house. Sofia Antonovna gave me a detailed relation of what had occurred there. Razumov himself had told her all about it, most minutely. Then, looking hard at me with her brilliant black eyes, "There are evil moments in every life. A false suggestion enters one's brain, and then fear is born, fear of oneself, fear for oneself. Or else a false courage, who knows? Well, call it what you like. But tell me, how many of them would deliver themselves up deliberately to perdition, as he himself says in that book, rather than go on living, secretly debased in their own eyes? How many?" And please mark this, he was safe when he did it. It was just when he believed himself safe and more, infinitely more, when the possibility of being loved by that admirable girl first dawned upon him, that he discovered that his bitterest railings, the worst wickedness, the devil work of his hate and pride, could never cover up the ignominy of the existence before him. There's character in such a discovery. I accepted her conclusion in silence. Who would care to question the grounds of forgiveness or compassion? However, it appeared later on that there was some compunction too, in the charity extended by the revolutionary world to Razum of the betrayer. Sofia Antonovna continued uneasily, and then, you know, he was the victim of an outrage. It was not authorized. Nothing was decided as to what was to be done with him. He had confessed voluntarily. And that Nikita who burst the drums of his ears purposely, out on the landing, you know, as if carried away by indignation, well, he has turned out to be a scoundrel of the worst kind, a traitor himself, a betrayer, a spy. Razumov told me he had charged him with it by a sort of inspiration. I had a glimpse of that brute, I said. How any of you could have been deceived for half a day passes my comprehension. She interrupted me. There. Don't talk of it. The first time I saw him, I too, was appalled. They cried me down. We were always telling each other, oh, you mustn't mind his appearance. ... and then he was always ready to kill. There was no doubt of it. He killed, yes. In both camps. The fiend. Then Sofia Antonovna, after mastering the angry trembling of her lips, told me a very queer tale. It went that Counselor Mikulin, traveling in Germany shortly after Razumov's disappearance from Geneva, happened to meet Peter Ivanovich in a railway carriage. Being alone in the compartment, these two talked together half the night, and it was then that Mikulin, the police chief, gave a hint to the arch-revolutionist as to the true character of the arch-slayer of gendarmes. It looks as though Mikulin had wanted to get rid of that particular agent of his own. He might have grown tired of him, or frightened of him. It must also be said that Mikulin had inherited the sinister Nikita from his predecessor in office. And this story too, I received without comment in my character of a mute witness of things Russian, unrolling their Eastern logic under my Western eyes. But I permitted myself a question. Tell me please, Sofia Antonovna, did Madame de S. leave all her fortune to Peter Ivanovich? Not a bit of it. The woman revolutionist shrugged her shoulders in disgust. He died without making a will. A lot of nephews and nieces came down from St. Petersburg, like a flock of vultures, and fought for her money amongst themselves. All beastly kammerherrs and maids of honor, abominable court flunkies. Phew! One does not hear much of Peter Ivanovich now, I remarked, after a pause. Peter Ivanovich, said Sofia Antonovna gravely, has united himself to a peasant girl. I was truly astonished. What? On the Riviera? What nonsense! Of course not. Sofia Antonovna's tone was slightly tart. Is he, then, living actually in Russia? It's a tremendous risk, isn't it? I cried. And all for the sake of a peasant girl. Don't you think it's very wrong of him? Sofia Antonovna preserved a mysterious silence for a while, then made a statement. He just simply adores her. Does he? Well then, I hope that she won't hesitate to beat him. Sofia Antonovna got up and wished me goodbye, as though as he had not heard a word of my impious hope. But, in the very doorway where I attended her, she turned round for an instant and declared in a firm voice, Peter Ivanovich is an inspired man. End of the Project Gutenberg text of Under Western Eyes, Joseph Conrad. Styles by Gutenberg Edition.